May it please the court, Ms. Howard. The facts of this case are not in dispute. Neither are the violations that were committed by the respondent. The only issue before the court this morning is the appropriate sanction. Respondent is an experienced attorney who joined the Bradshaw, Steele, Cochran, and Barons law firm in Cape Girardeau right out of law school in 1982. He became a partner 5 years later. 20 years later, in 2007, respondent relinquished his membership status and became a salaried employee because he was going through a difficult financial period that included IRS tax liens. He needed a stable income. Thereafter, respondent's salary was tied to the income that he generated for the law firm. Over the course of the next several years, respondent's annual income was gradually reduced because the income he generated to the firm decreased. Respondent left the firm in December 2015 and became in-house counsel for Drury Southwest. On 8 occasions, beginning in 2014 and continuing into 2015, respondent misappropriated client fee payments, advanced fee payments, rather than turn the money over to the law firm. The thefts ranged from $100 to $1,500 and totaled $4,900. Respondent knew that his taking of client funds in these 8 instances was wrong and against firm policy. In January 2016, just weeks after he left the law firm, the respondent was contacted by the law firm and they inquired regarding a $1,500 client payment that was unaccounted for. Respondent admitted to the law firm that he had taken the money and made restitution to the firm. At the time of that restitution, however, respondent affirmatively denied that he had taken any other client monies from the firm. That was untrue. Over the course of the next couple of months, the firm discovered 7 other thefts totaling $3,400 for which respondent made restitution. The panel that heard this case found 2 violations, 4-1.15 in that respondent failed to safekeep client funds, and 4-8.4C in that respondent engaged in conduct involving dishonesty. The panel found that respondent was eligible for probation because he was unlikely to harm the public, was able to practice law without causing the profession to fall into disrepute, and had not committed misconduct that warranted disbarment. Accordingly, the panel recommended to this court a 3-year stay suspension and a 3-year probation. While the informant agrees with the violations found by the panel, the informant rejected the panel's sanction recommendation and believes that an actual suspension is appropriate. This court's prior decisions leave no doubt that lawyers owe a duty of honesty and fidelity to the other lawyers in their law firm, and that a breach of that duty violates the rules. The Couples cases in 1997 and 1998, the Kazanis case in 2003, the Heffley case just earlier this year, all involved lawyers who engaged in differing levels of dishonesty directed toward their respective law firms. The Couples cases involved the surreptitious taking of client files from the attorney's law firm. In Couples 1, the court reprimanded Mr. Couples. Within 1 year, Mr. Couples was back before this court, having again concealed client files from his new law firm and failing to turn over client fees. After analyzing the appropriate ABA sanctions and appropriate mitigators and aggravators, the court issued an indefinite suspension to Mr. Couples with no leave to apply for reinstatement for 6 months. The Kazanis case in 2003 involved an intricate scheme to steal more than $160,000 from a St. Louis law firm, and Mr. Kazanis was ultimately prosecuted by the federal government for tax fraud. The court found his actions so repugnant that disbarment was the only appropriate sanction. Most recently, in the Heffley case, the court suspended an attorney who concealed the fact that he had possession of an Apple iPad that belonged to the law firm. The common thread running through all of these cases I've mentioned is a Rule 4-8.4C violation for dishonesty. Dishonest conduct, whether directed at a client or the law firm, reflects on the lawyer's character and fitness as an attorney and warrants either disbarment or suspension. The ABA sanctions also support suspension in this case. It's ABA standards, I should say. Standard 7.2 provides that suspension is appropriate when a lawyer knowingly engages in conduct that is a violation of a duty owed to the profession and causes injury or potential injury to a client, the public, or the legal system. Standard 7.2 is applicable to this case. It's undisputed the respondent knowingly took client money that should have gone to the firm, there was injury to the law firm, and the misconduct tarnished the integrity of the legal profession. there are mitigators and aggravators present. In aggravation, there's a prior disciplinary offense, an admonition in 2010. There was a dishonest, selfish motive present in these eight thefts. There was a pattern of misconduct in the eight thefts, and there's substantial experience in the practice of law. Respondent's been licensed for 35 years. In mitigation, there was timely, good faith effort to make restitution, and restitution was made. There was full and free disclosure to the informant and to the disciplinary hearing panel. Respondent produced evidence attesting to his reputation in the community, and he was clearly remorseful. The informant is mindful of the fact that dishonesty that's present in this case, involving as it does the theft of money, could warrant much more than a six-month suspension. It could warrant disbarment. In making the recommendation for an indefinite suspension with no leave to apply for 6 months, informant notes the good work that respondent has done in his personal life and professional career. His testimony before the panel reflected what I believe is a clear acknowledgement of the wrongfulness of his conduct and a heartfelt remorse for what he had done. And finally, he made full restitution to the law firm even before our office became aware of the misconduct. Not always the case in these matters when a client or law firm money is missing.
So why is the panel so wrong? Why do you disagree with the panel here?
It
happens more. Maybe it's just the cases that we see where you disagree with the panel. I'd like to know why the panel finds it one way, and you think the discipline should be so different.
Well, in my view, Judge Draper, the panel mitigated too much in this case, and found probation to be appropriate. A respondent argues that progressive discipline should be applied in the case, as the court applied in the Kriegel case to find probation to be appropriate. The thing that's different about this case from Kriegel and the other cases in which this court has suspended or disbarred lawyers, Kazanis, Heffley, Couples 2, is 8.4C, dishonesty. And I think that's what sets this case apart from a probation-type case like Kriegel.
It's all dishonesty, but Kazanis was a hefty dishonesty. This is a little less hefty, as it were.
And Kriegel was dishonesty. Right. Kriegel was dishonest. It was 3.3A, false testimony to the court, a very serious violation. Nevertheless, Kriegel did not involve 8.4C, which I set apart from many of the other rules in terms of character and fitness. If you do something in violation of 8.4C that calls into question your character and fitness, you've done something fraudulent, dishonest, and made a misrepresentation, then I think it sets apart from these other rule violations, frankly, and is a level of dishonesty that goes to your character and fitness as an attorney. And in those types of cases, I don't think a period of probation, I couldn't even think of a term that would address that type of dishonest conduct. What sort of probationary term would we impose on a lawyer who's been dishonest? In my view, just simply monitoring them is not enough. So in my view, dishonest conduct, 8.4C violation warrants either an actual suspension or disbarment. I do think there are mitigators here that would suggest that it shouldn't be a disbarment case, that suspension is sufficient, and even at the low end of that suspension is what we're recommending. However, I do think it's an actual suspension case. I don't think progressive discipline should be applied because it's simply, you look at the McMillan case, Ryan McMillan, that was decided just this past June. This court disbarred Mr. McMillan, no prior disciplinary history. Kazanis, 2003, disbarred, no prior disciplinary history. Donahoe, 2003, theft of client fees, suspended, actual 1 year suspension, no disciplinary history for Mr. Donahoe. The Forge case, going back almost 30 years, 1988, involved the failure to handle a retainer properly and lying to a special master, 8.4C again violated, no disciplinary history and actual suspension. So I think if you look at the line of cases involving this type of misconduct, you won't see probation, you'll see an actual suspension in my view. Obviously that's up to the court, and I think the Kriegel case is in opposite to the facts of this case. In conclusion, respondent engaged in the pattern of professional misconduct in the case, and in the process of engaging in that misconduct violated multiple provisions of the rules. The violations were serious, they were knowing, and breached the fiduciary duty that he owed to his law firm. He failed to safekeep client funds and engaged in conduct involving deceit and misrepresentation. Based on this court's prior decisions, based on a review of the ABA standards and after considering the appropriate mitigators and aggravators, the informant is requesting that the court indefinitely suspend the respondent with no leave to apply for reinstatement for at least 6 months. Unless there's any other questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for the patience of the court. I would suggest to you, especially to you, Justice Fisher, that I believe that there are corollaries to the Kriegel decision. I'm going to suggest to you that my worthy opponent believes that the conduct of Mr. Gehrke is such a serious infraction of the rules that it's much more serious than the infraction associated with the Kriegel case, but I would not have to refer, Justice Fisher, to your dissent in the Kriegel decision, where I might suggest to you that you might disagree with that analysis, that Mr. Kriegel's conduct in that case, in which the dishonesty involved in that case were misrepresentations to the court, falsities, what might be suggested as suborning perjury and having a witness testify falsely in the court, in having facts of a matter intentionally misrepresented to an opponent, that type of misconduct rises to a very high level of deceit and falsity, and to indicate that the conduct of Mr. Gehrke does not rise to that rises way above that level. It has been argued that that is not comparable. And in that case, in the Kriegel case, even an affidavit associated with the termination of parental rights where Mr. Kriegel's client represented that there was not a party that was interested in the custody of a child, when indeed that affidavit that was filed in that adoption case was absolutely false, a false pleading, that this court in the dissent in the case stated that there's no higher level of falsity than the filing of a false pleading. And Mr. Kriegel was awarded in that case a serious punishment, but that was the staying of a suspension. I might suggest to you, Judge Draper, that the disciplinary hearing panel in this case was confronted with a unique situation. The line, Your Honor, each of you, ladies and gentlemen of this court, have before you typically in these kinds of cases something that this disciplinary hearing panel, when they had the opportunity to meet my longtime colleague, Mr. Gehrke, they met something very unique, and that is an individual who had been involved in serious misconduct. But he came before a disciplinary hearing panel and did something that was unusual, something that on his behalf I am doing today, and that is he looked three individuals in the eye, as you have the transcript, and was not incredible, excuse my double negative, made no excuses, made nothing but apologies, and said, I have acknowledged these offenses. I acknowledge them with remorse. In the argument of my worthy colleague, he stated that their firm discovered seven more violations. Their firm did not discover them. As the brief sets out, Mr. Gehrke, and you have the email, contacted the firm and said, I must get this off my conscience. He made a handwritten list and came forward and said, this is what I have done. I have done this. I have a check in hand. I have done wrong. He makes no apologies. And he told the disciplinary hearing panel, if I had the ability to set back the hands of time, I would undo it completely. But I cannot undo it completely. But I will do everything short of that. I will pay back the money. I will give
you
names.
What does it say to the public if you engage in theft and there's no actual suspension? And what does it say to other lawyers?
Well, who might be tempted to engage in comparable conduct.
And he understands. The article in the Southeast Missourian yesterday announcing what Mr. Gehrke had done. So the public is aware. The public is aware of the theft. But the disciplinary hearing panel has found that Mr. Gehrke, who has had a 30-plus year career in practice, and is known as being, people are shocked, as being a very honorable person, can go back and continue to practice with honor.
Is there an explanation in the record for besides that he was short of funds?
There is no other explanation but that he found himself in very bad financial situation. And he's made no excuses. There are no excuses. He would not come before you and make an excuse. It is something that is abhorrible conduct. But my opponents would have your rules, your Supreme Court rules, 5.225 sub A, sub 2, rewritten to say, in cases of dishonesty, he has to serve a suspension. Well, I respectfully state to the court that Mr. Gehrke is an anomaly. He is one of these cases where when he is dishonest, as he has acknowledged that he has been, he has not continued to be dishonest. He has not been dishonest in all his life. And that disciplinary hearing panel had asked Mr. Spade, a very good friend and colleague of his, do you believe that he is dishonest? And he said, no. I am saying to you, he acted dishonestly. He truly acted dishonestly over a period of time, but he is not fundamentally dishonest. I've known him since we were freshmen in high school, and he is going to go back to practicing law in a way that is not dishonest. And, the hearing panel met him, listened to him, and believed him as a finder of fact, and accepted that the way he had acted, not just how he acted in front of the disciplinary hearing panel, but the way he acted in response to the firm contacting him about the $1,500. So the same types of things, of course, that the ABA standards asks this court to recognize. The recognition of his misconduct, his remorse, his acknowledgement of it, his immediate restitution before the Office of the Chief Disciplinary Counsel, before they were involved, owning up to it, telling, as Mr. Spaeth testified, going to lawyer colleagues, going to lawyer friends, and telling them, this is what I have done. I have been involved in this misconduct. I am ashamed of it. I am embarrassed. I am embarrassed for myself. I have what I have done to the profession. And I have made good as much as I can make good. And now I need to start over. I've left a fine firm. I've now been fired from a good job. I'm going to hang up my shingle. And so I am here on his behalf to ask this court to give him an opportunity to continue with this. And I ask this court to look at the precedent that's been before you. Couples 1 and, heaven forbid, Couples 2. I've told Mr. Gehrke, if there's a Gehrke 2, by the way, Diane Howard's not going to be here on his behalf. And for Couples 1, Couples 1, even though this court, not each of you literally, but this court figuratively, he's given a break. He comes back for Couples 2, he's given a 6-month suspension. I consider that a break when the same respondent appears a year later for the same type of misconduct. And Mr. Gehrke's matter is compared to Couples 2 when the same respondent for the same type of infraction is here before this court a year later. I consider this court to be quite generous when this matter is compared to an individual who goes through a complex scheme of $169,000 of theft from a law firm. Again, those cases, one of the responsibilities of this court is to look at the prior case law. And for the Casanis decision, that case is not a comparable case. Again, dishonesty is dishonesty, it said, but it's not. The violation of the same rule is not the same. This court, one of the factors you should look at is the harm. And so $4,900 and $169,000 are not the same.
What about the integrity of the profession? Do you think they make that same distinction that that the lawyers who steal money, do you think they would look at that in a grossly different sense based on the amounts?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I believe that the integrity of the profession, of course, is important. I mean, the self-serving answer, that of course it's important. But in the factors that this court is required to look at, the amount of harm is a factor. And that is one of the factors the court is required to look at, which is a matter that distinguishes the Gehrke matter from the Casanis matter, that the $4,900 difference is different from the $169,000 difference, which does allow for a distinction between the two. And I would suggest to you, respectfully, Your Honor, that that is one of the integrity of the profession is one of the big reasons that allows this court to make a difference even between the Heffel case and some of the other cases in which these respondents just seem to have such a difficulty with remorse and credibility, even when you're dealing with a minor matter such as an iPad, where a respondent has disserved the profession, and they come before this court, and they continue to disserve themselves by not being credible, not being remorseful, and not allowing this court to find that they're going to credit their profession in the future by demonstrating integrity, even over something little. And my suggestion to you, this is just kind of a Diane Howardism, is if you don't have credibility over little things, that makes it even harder to have credibility over big things. And when I review many of these cases, the respondents seem to have difficulty with remorse, with accepting responsibility, with being credible with this court. I would suggest to this court that that's one of the biggest distinctions in the Gehrke case. Mr. Gehrke has shown that remorse, has demonstrated himself to be credible, and that the acceptance of the responsibility puts him steps ahead of many individuals if placed on probation in continuing his career in a way that he enjoyed a career for many, many years. So I do hope, on behalf of my client, that you will consider probation, staying as suspension, as appropriate discipline for my client. Thank you so much for your attention today.
Thank you. Just a couple points, Your Honors. First of all, I think we can agree there was an 8.4C violation, dishonesty, theft. What I think also sets this case apart is the fact that once the $1,500 payment was discovered by the firm, it was a check. It was the only payment of the eight that was stolen that was an actual check. It was a check made payable to Mr. a Garrity, and he put it into his own checking account. That's how the firm discovered there was a problem here when they went to the client and said, where's our money? When they confronted him, he admitted that he had taken that check, but he also said no other client money is missing. And where I would point you to is the appendix, page 127, Informants Exhibit D, a string of emails where he basically says the cash deposits were not from any clients, no client monies were retained, when he's talking about any other cash deposits that he deflected and stole and put in his own account.
Well, Ms. Howard said he eventually did tell them.
He absolutely came forward.
How long a time was that?
Well, I dispute. I think it was the law firm that discovered these additional cash payments. I think counsel says no, it was Mr. Garrity that came forward. Either way, as soon as it was called to his attention, he came forward, admitted it, I believe, and made restitution, Judge Stith. So, yeah, there's no dispute about the fact that quick restitution was made. But there is this additional dishonesty in saying, well, that was the only, you caught me on that one, but that's the only one that is impacted by what my thefts. Mm-hmm. In fact, there were seven more cash with thefts that came into play. In terms of who protects the integrity of the profession, it's this court. You know, if we depend on respondents to do that, you know, I think we're in a bad situation. It's the integrity of the profession that this court protects, and it's informants' belief that integrity needs to be protected by delineating for the public and the rest of the bar clear lines of demarcation for when you're going to suspend someone. And one of those demarcation lines should be you violated 8.4C by stealing money from somebody, either the law firm or a client, but you stole money. Everything else about the restitution, the remorse, goes to mitigation, but I don't think you ever mitigate to the point where you put someone who's done this on probation for 3 years. And so it's our position that what I consider a minimal actual suspension of 6 months is appropriate in this case. If these other mitigators weren't present, we'd be asking for more than 6 months. So the fact is that in our view, this is a significant, serious violation. I think we can all agree on that. And I think the integrity of the profession requires an actual period of suspension.
What was the prior admonition for?
Judge Powell, it was in 2010. It was for lack of communication, violation of 4-1.4, a failure to provide a client with a full accounting, 4-1.15, and a failure to disclose a witness to opposing counsel, which was somehow charged under diligence rule 4-1.3 back in 2010. It was an admonition. It had to do with a condemnation case where I believe that Mr. Garrity represented a property owner regarding an easement that was being taken. Thank you all.
Case will be submitted.